Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr., and we had a little chat this week about what should we talk about, and we thought about talking about some of the myths of obesity and other things, but we decided that we haven't talked about sodium glucose transporters, inhibitors yet, and these are really cool drugs. I'm going to let my brother kind of discuss SGLT2 inhibitors.
Yeah,
really have become popular drugs
that, for a variety of good reasons, yeah, as it turns out. And I have some stories about going way back to when they were being developed too.
Yeah, we talk about GLP-1 receptor agonists all the time and amazing drugs. However, there's another camp of physicians who probably like the SGLT2 inhibitors more so.
Yeah, but they're very different.
They are different.
And they definitely have different roles. And I'll tell you, especially from the endocrinology perspective, those people who have more severe disease, diabetes, heart disease, et cetera, they're going to be on both of these. They have sort of complementary mechanisms of actions, especially if costs were better, right? We talk about that all the time with the other meds. These have this, you know, some similar issues. They're all relatively new. Cost is an issue, but they have really good cardiometabolic benefits, meaning they're good for people's weight, heart, kidneys, and that's, we'll talk a little bit about that today without being too sciencey.
So tell us what in a 1 to 2 sentences, what do these drugs do?
Yeah. So I always tell people, hey, you know what? You probably see commercials for the brand names such as Jardiance, Farxiga, Invokana. There are a couple others and even some more recent ones recently approved, but we'll just stick with those for now because they're the ones that have like all the robust data. And these are sodium glucose cotransporter 2 inhibitors. And I tell patients essentially what they do is they trick your kidneys into peeing out sugar. And so that might sound silly, but I'll tell you, back when I was in residency, I saw the phase 2 trials starting to be done, phase 1 and 2. And I thought, well, this is interesting for diabetes. We're instead of your urinating out sugar because your sugars are too high, these medications, the first one I saw was dapagliflozin, which is now known as Farxiga. And then there was canagliflozin, which is known as Invokana. And then there's empagliflozin, which is known as Jardiance. Like I said, those are the ones we'll talk about. And I did a journal club when I was like a second year.
I was there as a med student.
Oh my God, that's so funny. So people really think we're crazy. Somehow we got together when you were, when I was in residency. And so a really cool mentor was there. He was a gastroenterologist, Dr. Smith, John Smith, if you remember him. Really cool guy. And I guess I did an okay job with my journal club presentation, but he did say something to me afterwards. He said, you know, I know this sounds kind of cool, this mechanism and everything. He's like, but you know, I just don't see anything coming of them.
Yeah. I remember that.
And boy, did, yeah. I mean, that stuck with me and I don't have his contact
info.
Boy, was he wrong. I'll tell you, I mean, yeah.
Not even close.
I wonder if he remembers that because even people in other specialties know of these medications for how they work. So the bottom line is,
this was 2010, I believe.
Yeah.
I believe it was 2010.
Absolutely. 2009, 2010 sort of thing. So for example, if people can imagine a nephron, which nobody can imagine that because it's in the kidney. So only the kidney doctors can do that. But our kidneys, you know, they take in blood, they filter in and out things, including water and electrolytes and sugar. We should not normally be urinating out sugar, but the blood, you know, goes in and, you know, and it's like 180 liters per day. And within that, it's like 180 grams per day of glucose, of sugar. Okay. And then there are a couple of these sodium glucose cotransporters in the kidney. And essentially, the number 2 one that's earlier on gets rid of about 160 grams of that 180 grams per day. Okay. So the bottom line is, don't worry about the numbers. Sugar's going into our kidneys. Our kidneys are trying to put the sugar back into our blood. Okay. Because we're not supposed to urinate out. Not supposed to.
Not supposed to.
That only happens when your sugars are high, like with diabetes, type 1 or type 2 diabetes, you have hyperglycemia. And then the rest actually goes out with this, with an SGLT1, and there actually are some inhibitors of that. And so, and there were some genetic, you know, we always talk about how genetic studies lead up to these things. So there are people who have genetically defunct SGLT2 transporters, okay? And they urinate out sugar all the time, even if they don't have diabetes. And it turned out to appear to be kind of beneficial for sugars, for weight, for heart and kidney disease. And so that's where these came up with. So it sounded pretty good, right? So people with type 2 diabetes, give them a pill that blocks this SGLT2, and they'll urinate out sugar. And so then instead of that that happening, when you give these pills, basically it blocks that out, and you're not peeing out that, or you're not reabsorbing that 160 grams, right? And so then essentially you pee it out. The other transporter I talked about does try to make up for it, but not all the time, or not as much as it could. And it ultimately ends up being about 60 grams of glucose per day on average, right? So even if anybody who doesn't have diabetes did that, they would urinate out sugar.
Yeah. So anybody listening, so you and I, if we took one of these, we don't urinate sugar right now, but we probably would if we took one of these.
Yeah, exactly. Medicines. You would. And one thing to remember for doctors, nurses, patients out there, if you're taking one of these medications and somebody checks your urine, they'd say, oh my God, you're urinating out sugar. Something's wrong. Go talk to your doctor or your endocrinologist or something. That's normal. You're supposed to urinate out sugar on these. It's not because you're hyperglycemic. So with that concept, you know, obviously it was thought to help with blood sugars, but also think about it. You're losing calories, right? So how do you get some weight loss with these? Yeah, you get a little bit of pretty good weight loss. And it's like 2 to 3% placebo subtracted weight loss.
It's not bad.
They don't work quite as well if your kidneys don't work as well. But they do get that whether you have diabetes or not. And there have been studies, including some, I think, from our friend Kevin Hall at the NIH, who looks at the energy balance models.
Yeah.
That it really is secondary to a true energy deficit, because the other thing that happens with these medications is water follows the sugar. And so we're going to talk about how they're really good for blood pressure, but you do lose water. So you need to stay hydrated. And so people lose a little bit of water weight. But this 2 to 3% weight loss is actually true energy deficit, because you're losing sugar in your urine. Now, the only little thing that comes with that, if that's the only thing you do, kind of like exercise, you know, like when you add exercise to somebody's regimen, the average weight loss is only like 2% weight loss on average. So everyone compensates differently. Well, on average, people tend to have a physiologic compensation where they end up eating more. So they don't just keep losing more and more and more weight, right? That goes back to the disease of obesity and the pathophysiology that's kind of working against us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So you can't just start taking these and go, oh, I'm just going to lose a bunch of weight. Right. Your body will compensate. And that's where these other medicines come into play to make up for that increased appetite from the loss of calories.
And so then, for example, like with canagliflozin, in one of the earlier trials with this, especially if the kidney function was normal, they were losing about 3% compared to about 1% for placebo.
Yeah.
So it's a couple percent more.
These were approved, what, 2012? 2013.
Yeah, pretty early on. I mean, because it was 2015 when we had the huge cardiovascular outcome trial that we'll talk about with empagliflozin.
Because I remember it was Invokana, which is canagliflozin, came out. And I remember writing my first prescription for it while in residency. And I made a big deal and made a big post. And people were like, what the hell are you even talking about? My attending doctors were like, what the hell drug even is this? And I'm like, I don't know. My brother talked about it about a few years ago when it was in the phase one trial.
Oh, that's great. That's outstanding. So yeah, back to the compensation thing. So, you know, it should be about 200 calories a day that you're losing in your urine. Okay. And so when they started looking at this, the expected weight loss over, you know, a certain amount of time over, you know, like a year or two should have been about 11%, but the observed weight loss was only like 3%. And so they figured out the physiologic compensation due to the pathophysiology of obesity was they increased their caloric intake by about 13%. So that's the problem, you know? And so basically you end up eating more because we got to find a way to help with that.
So anybody listening to this, you know, like there have been studies, there have been talks about adding these to obesity regimens, basically weight loss regimens, not, even if you don't have type 2 diabetes or some of the new indications, I mean, they're looking at chronic kidney disease and heart failure. We're not there yet. It's do the benefits outweigh some of the risks? Do you want to talk about some of the risks?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll talk about that. So, but you just mentioned combining them with obesity medicine.
Yeah.
So, a few years ago, again, canagliflozin, there was a trial. Some of our mentors were involved in this, where they compared placebo to canagliflozin to phenermine, again, old school appetite suppressant we've talked about before, to a combination of canagliflozin and phenermine. And over 26 weeks, the placebo got 1.1%, pretty typical. The canagliflozin got almost 3%, like I said in that other trial. The phenermine got almost 5% weight loss, which is relatively typical for straight up monotherapy with phenermine. The combination of canagliflozin and phenermine got 8% weight loss. So again, that extra 2-3% in addition to the phenermine seemed additive.
It was additive.
So that's pretty helpful. So there was a 7% placebo subtracted weight loss for that. And that seems to be the case if you look at all the studies, especially compared to other diabetes meds. It's very beneficial for weight. And then, like I said, there's a little bit of improved glycemic control or sugar control for those with type 2 diabetes. It's not amazing, like say compared to the GLP-1 receptor agonist.
Yeah, what's the A1C?
So it actually raises... it ranges from about 0.5 to a little over 1% A1C reduction.
That's not bad.
It depends on what studies you're looking at, because as you may know, and for people out there, in these types of trials, when you have a starting average sugar that's higher, so A1Cs that are higher, 8, 9%, et cetera, and depending on what other medications are involved, you get more average A1C reduction. So if your A1C is 6.5 and you start one of these, well, you might get a little bit of benefit. It's going to go from 6.5 to 6.
And but for anybody that hasn't listened to our podcast before, hemoglobin A1C is the average blood sugar. It's a measure of average blood sugar over basically 3 months. So just anybody that's not familiar with these, normal is under 5.7%. Pre-diabetes is 5.7 to 6.4 or under 6.5, and 6.5 and higher is type 2 diabetes. And what would you say uncontrolled type 2 diabetes percent is? 10? 9, 10?
Well, that gets nuanced.
Yeah, but
somewhere around. I'm not going to use that term, uncontrolled.
We'll say...
We could there's so many little nuances that I'm not going to use that
term. Where it's like, holy crap. Anyway, pretty bad is more like, I'd say 9, 10.
We want everyone to have an A1C or average sugar that correlates to A1C under 8%.
Yeah.
And that even goes for like our elderly people with lots of complications on insulin. Whereas someone who is not on any insulin and, we're doing it with diet, exercise, plus or minus some of these meds we're talking about, we want them under 6.5.
Yeah. So a drop of 0.5% to 1% isn't too bad compared to what's the GLP-1s, like what's the tirzepatide can get. Now it's getting close to like 2%.
2%, yeah. And again, it still matters as to what your starting A1C is. So for example, we've talked a lot about canagliflozin because that was one of the earlier ones. When it's compared to one of those old medications called glimepiride, which is a sulfonylurea, these medicines just kind of trick your pancreas into making too much more insulin. They both got about, with an average A1C starting off of 7.8, they both got not quite 1% A1C reduction. So that's not like a ton, but it's pretty good, right? For starting off at 7.8, it got them down to goal of, a 7%. When it was compared to something called sitagliptin, which is Januvia, or those DPP-4 inhibitors, if people want to go back to our talks, I don't know if we talked about that much, but they both got closer to more like 1% weight loss when the average A1C was starting off over 8.
A1C, not weight loss.
Or sorry, yeah, 1% to A1C reduction.
Yeah, okay.
So there's pretty decent, glycemic benefits, but it's not even that's the real issue.
So, but go beyond the glycemic benefits. What's the major thing here for why these are cool?
So to set up really we're going to talk about the heart and the kidneys. So they definitely have good blood pressure benefits. So they can get like 7-8% blood pressure reduction when you're not on blood pressure meds, and 40-50% reduction when you're on 1-2 hypertension or blood pressure medications.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Ambulatory blood pressure improves. There's a dose response meta-analysis that's out there that shows basically all the doses are about the same, by the way. That's another little nugget with these. The dosing, we have different doses of them, but they're all about the same for all these benefits that we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so they're definitely strongly recommended for people who have type 2 diabetes and a history of heart disease and kidney disease, because in 2015, think about this. We're acting on the kidney. We're tricking it to urinate out sugar. There have been some issues in the past with diabetes medications and increasing heart disease risk. So all medications for diabetes have these huge cardiovascular outcome trials. We've talked about them with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. And we've never really had like a dramatic benefit. But in 2015, I think it was at the European Association for the Study of Diabetes, all the nerds like us gave a standing ovation when they read out the EMPA-REG outcome trial, because there was a 14% reduction in cardiovascular outcomes, cardiovascular death, heart attack, and stroke. Most of that, by the way, driven by cardiovascular death. Now, that was a high risk for cardiovascular disease group. But the other medications, canagliflozin and to some degree dapagliflozin, showed similar benefits. But it really turns out to be mostly, you know, especially when people are at risk of heart failure. So people with type 2 diabetes, especially if they have established heart disease, are at pretty darn high risk for heart failure. And the huge benefits for the heart in these are when we reduce the risk of hospitalization for heart failure, but also just the overall cardiovascular outcomes. And it, like I said, with empagliflozin, which is Jardiance, reducing the cardiovascular risk of death specifically, which is important. More benefit for those who have established atherosclerotic disease, more benefit for those who have like established heart failure specifically. When you don't have those things, there aren't as huge robust benefits, but there does seem to be this trend in heart failure benefits specifically. Even in people without heart failure, just because they're at such high risk for heart failure, there does tend to be fewer like hospitalizations for heart failure, for example. And it doesn't really matter if you're male or female when they analyze these by sex. And even age, over 65, under 65, turns out not to really matter that much. So there's a really good cardiovascular benefit for people who have really high risk of disease.
Yeah, pretty amazing drugs. And now, do they have an indication beyond just type 2 diabetes?
Yeah. So very literally, to reduce risk of cardiovascular death in for Jardiance specifically, and to reduce the risk of cardiovascular events in the other ones. And now they're all starting to get these studies in people without diabetes, yeah, who have heart failure and kidney disease. Because as it turns out, all those big cardiovascular outcome trials also said, hey, you know what? These are also looking to protect people's kidneys, especially if they have some protein in their urine. And even though they don't work great for sugar control and weight loss, if you have chronic kidney disease, it turns out that they are even more protective of the kidneys when we do that. And there's all sorts of potential
mechanisms,
theoretical ways they do this, especially with the way they increase ketogenesis, which might be good for some of the fuel for the heart and the kidneys. There's obviously reduced load on it, just like, you know, if you can imagine the urine, the water issue, decreasing preload, afterload, all that stuff that the cardiologists like to get into.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is they really, really, really reduce the risk of heart failure, really significantly. And then now we see they really improve or reduce the risk of progression of chronic kidney disease, especially even when kidneys don't work that well, regardless of the fact that they're not working that great for sugar control.
What is there data yet? Because we have this with metformin and GLP-1s and even acarbose, I suppose. But have they started trying to do this to see if it prevents type 2 diabetes in those with pre-diabetes? Do we have any data for that yet?
Yeah, so there are some data. They're kind of preliminary, and, yeah, and they're kind of almost as you would expect. So if you can imagine someone with obesity type, pre-diabetes, impaired glucose tolerance, impaired fasting glucose, they definitely, one, they help with weight loss. So that helps treat the underlying disease issue, right? And they very literally directly improve glycemia. So depending on how you look at it, they definitely do have some data now for preventing diabetes progression in those with pre-diabetes.
Okay. So then we went over the major benefits, the risks. There are a few risks.
Yeah. Few risks, overall pretty darn safe. But yeah, I always tell people, when you urinate out sugar out of your urethra,
yeah,
so for guys, out of your
penis hole.
and with females, there is an increased risk of yeast infections. Now, yeah, a lot of females are kind of used to that. It's not actually a huge deal. It's easily treated. Guys aren't used to hearing that. So that is definitely something they need to be aware of. There are thoughts of concerns of urinary tract infections, but if you really look at the studies, it's not really much more than placebo. So it's something to kind of be aware of, but it doesn't really seem to be an increased risk. For those patients, so it has been studied and used a lot off-label for people with type 1 diabetes. Now remember, these people don't have any insulin. And when you are urinating out sugar, and depending on what you're doing with your diet, you are increasing that ketogenesis, kind of like going on an extraordinarily extreme keto diet, but not from what you're eating or not eating, right? And so when you don't have much insulin production, it can increase your risk of something called, we call it euglycemic or normal sugar diabetic ketoacidosis. So it's something that is very important. So people with type 1 diabetes, it's not indicated. It might be used off label by your endocrinologist, and you just need to be very aware, be very well hydrated.
Yeah, the symptoms of it.
Yeah, if you get sick, you feel like you're nauseous, you're not eating much, you probably should.
And your sugar's like normal, basically.
Yeah, right. And so I've only had one patient, and it was someone who had bariatric surgery. Mm. This person had type 2 diabetes, but the person had high cardiovascular risk, so I really wanted him to get on his Jardiance after surgery. And unfortunately, he was not feeling that great, and he wasn't getting a lot of fluids in. And, you know, unfortunately, the surgeons didn't quite know this. And the patient obviously called them to ask what to do. And he ended up in the hospital in DKA. Yeah. And his sugars weren't high. It was just because he was sick and not getting enough fluid. So there are ways to mitigate that. I always tell patients, and you obviously talk to your own doctor about this, but, you know, if in doubt, when in doubt, if you're sick, ill, not eating or drinking much, just don't take it.
Yeah.
You know, that's even if you have type 2 diabetes, these are just ways to prevent
it. If somebody's on a ketogenic diet, I try to avoid it, even though it's probably fine, but there are case studies around people doing
that. Yeah, I'll tell you, that's probably fine. Again, it comes back to these other little mitigating causes. There was a nice statement from the American Diabetes Association a couple of years ago. It's specifically more for people with type 1 diabetes if they're on these, how to prevent those, but I actually use those same precautions for people with type 2 diabetes just in case something comes up, just to be aware of. So, but now, yeah, like I said, so now all guidelines really strongly recommend these types of medications for those with type 2 diabetes and heart disease, especially heart failure. They're now going to be indicated for people with heart failure without diabetes. And that's all different types of heart failure: preserved ejection fraction, reduced ejection fraction, and for those with kidney disease, all the way down to something, a glomerular filtration rate down to 20. If anybody understands that, it basically means you're getting darn close to your kidneys not working very well.
Yeah. Mm. So, all right. So for those listening, hey, if you have type 2 diabetes, these are these are things that we probably want you to at least consider. I'm always GLP-1 or GTFO, but SGLT2 inhibitors.
Yeah. So again, it's not just about the sugar. Yeah. We're talking holistic therapy of people with these disease processes, and they have great overall health cardiometabolic benefits for those who really need them. The more disease you have, the more benefit you get from them, for sure.
Yeah. Very good. All right. Well, hopefully everybody learned about how peeing out sugar can actually be a good thing. And make sure you share this with anybody who has type 2 diabetes or high risk or anything like that, heart failure,
kidney disease, all that stuff they should be discussing.
Just so everybody knows, we do not make any money from these pharmaceutical companies. We're just very interested in the science around these things. Again, maybe someday we'll make some money from them, but as of right now, we make zero money from Big Pharma.
This has not been brought to you by Boehringer Ingelheim or whoever else.
Ingelheim or Schmidt, whatever.
Dingleberries.
And Dingleberry Schmidt. All right, here's our outro. Give us a good review. Bye.
Godspeed.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.